This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Panelists
to introduce themselves. So, Ari, you want to take that song?
Hi, my name is Adi. I'm from New York, but I was organizing at Hampton University in Virginia.
You can tell us your pronouns.
Oh, yeah, my pronouns are he, him, or they, them.
And the campaign?
The Divest from Death campaign with the centers at Hampton University.
Hi, my name is Noah. I use he, they pronouns. I was born in New York, but I spent most of my life living in the Middle East and North Africa. I go to UMass Amherst, and our campaign is centered around cutting ties with Raytheon, which is one of the largest military contractors in the world.
Hey everyone, good evening. My name is Alex. I use he, him pronouns. I am based in Houston, but originally hail from occupied Palestine, from Jerusalem, Al-Quds, Sedamant, if anyone out there. And I was part of the University of Houston's Divest from Death campaign, and we targeted the five largest weapons manufacturers, and we're pushing for our university to cut our partnerships with these institutions.
Hi everybody, my name is Thundi. I use she, her pronouns. I was born and raised in Chicago, and I've been working with Boeing Arms Genocide since it started, and I'm really excited to be here with you all.
So these are gonna be the people who are gonna be speaking to the power that they've been building in all different parts of the state. So just to go a little bit more into detail about the work that you guys been doing, people wanna know, what is the work that you've been doing? Who have you been targeting, and how does this connect to militarism at large? But we want to know specifically in your lives how you're working to make an intervention with the military-industrial complex, within the military-industrial complex, and if so, like what type of victories have you seen in your campaign so far? So first I want to kick it over to Ari and talk specifically about like BIPOC exploitation, and specifically like what that looks like going to a historically black college and university whose mission is to swear by black lives and black success. So could you tell us a little bit about the ways in which you've seen predatory recruiting in schools and beyond? Because for a lot of us, the first time in which we had interactions with the military industrial complex was seeing recruiters in our high school. So could you speak a little bit to your experience with that and some of the things that you've seen?
Yeah, absolutely. So Hampton University has a disproportionately high amount of ROTC students in the ROTC program. And a lot of these students come from military families or just generally from disparate economic backgrounds. The military does a very good job with their public relations and just their media and image of convincing these people that the American dream is achievable through the military. And a lot of these people, even having negative experiences with the military-industrial complex, having understanding the harms of police brutality and the militarization of the police force, understanding how the military like disbands people once they're done very disposably, how the VA is very, I don't want to say useless, but very unhelpful to many veterans, but they look at the fact that they get college tuition and that they get, you know, help with the GI Bill, getting a house, and they're like, this is enough for me, and I will dedicate my life to this and swear by it, even though they see the problems within the system. And for a lot of HBCUs as an institution, there's a deep history of Civil War heroes, like Union generals and officers who helped to found the school or fund the school or generally have a huge part in the building and the base of the school. So there's a very strong reverence at HBCUs for the ranks of the military and for the discipline of the military and the general culture of militarism, having a don't ask, don't tell, keep your head down and follow orders attitude. And so a lot of HBCUs are like prime sites, prime real estate for the military to try and find officers and create more ranks. A lot of programs, especially in the 60s and 70s during the Vietnam War and Korean War in the 50s, a lot of HBCUs beefed up their ROTC programs because white officers didn't want to lead troops of color. And so they said, let's go to the black universities and try and recruit them to our cause and recruit them and persuade them with free tuition and with whatever else they could, whatever crumbs of a good life they could throw at these people in order to convince them that they should join the military. And it worked. And now there's a lot of people who can't see beyond the military giving them something in order to understand what is taken from them and what is taken from their communities. I also want to touch on how specifically affirmative action has been repealed recently, but not from military schools. So military schools are still allowed to have race-based admissions, but not other schools and universities, which is a policy decision saying that specifically you are allowed to get an education in how to kill, but we don't want you to get an education in anything else. But you can become an officer, you can become whatever type of militant motherfucker you want to be, but not an artist or an educator or a doctor or a lawyer. And at HBCUs, this is especially prevalent because a lot of people will say, oh yeah, I'll be a lawyer once I'm done in the military, without considering the fact that you might not come home from that, or that it might change you in ways you don't understand, or in ways they understand that they've seen with their military relatives who have served and come back scarred, you know? So yeah, it's a very intentional and insidious way that the system economically disparages people. And the military specifically is the number one lobbyist against free education, because they know that if education was free, there would be no one in the military. And so especially black and brown bodies, which are viewed as more disposable in this country, are recruited and heavily preyed upon to fill the ranks of the military.
Thank you for that, Aria. It makes me like reflect on my own experiences as someone who graduated from a historically black college or university. And as you were talking, it made me think about like literally my school's model. My HBCU, Howard, is also named after a Civil War general. Our motto is literally in truth and service. So it makes me think about like, in regards to that service aspect, like, is it connected to like the military industrial complex? And I was thinking about that as you were speaking. So thank you for that. So just to talk a little bit more about some other folks who are up here with us and the ways in which you've been building power at your campuses and how you've been connecting that to militarism. I want to kick it over to Noah to talk specifically about some of the work you've been doing at UMass to get Raytheon off your campus. And just, yeah, what does the militarism pipeline look like and how does it manifest on your campus?
So when we talk about militarism at UMass, really we're talking about three separate campaigns that kind of all converge. Number one, UMass has a fairly large ROTC, which is, I think, particularly insidious because UMass is a large state school that takes in sort of the you know, general working class of Massachusetts, you know, the people who need in-state tuition in order to afford school at all. Those are the kinds of people a lot of the times that end up at UMass. But then the three main campaigns are against Raytheon's ties in the comp sci school, the engineering school, and the business school. And there are particular points that I want to hit on this that are, I think, particularly shocking. So Eisenberg, our business school, is a direct partner with Raytheon. Raytheon is involved in our Center for Data Sciences Industry Affiliates Program. UMass was actually awarded a laboratory by an agency affiliated with the Department of Defense. Two people on the board of Raytheon went to UMass Amherst. Two people on the board of engineering at UMass work for Raytheon. And UMass Lowell actually has a Raytheon Research Institute. And pretty much the entirety of the engineering industry partnerships are war profiteers if they're not Raytheon. But it goes beyond that, right? It's a culture at UMass. When you talk about a pipeline, you know, these are policies, but they're policies that create an atmosphere at UMass where people think of themselves as sort of like willing participants in this system. And so one sort of prime example that I give, I'm a math major, and I remember in my Calc 3 class, we were just sort of, I don't even remember what we were doing, but the professor started out, you know, giving us a problem that day, and he was like, okay, so you're working at Raytheon. You are creating a missile defense system. And I was just sitting there, and I was like, what the fuck are we doing? What is good? But I mean, it really is that pervasive, right? Like you have students who know exactly what's going on. I remember one of my roommates, he didn't work for Raytheon, but he was an intern at a different weapons manufacturing company, and he was like, yeah, you know, I know that everything I'm doing is going to be going to, like, murdering, like, brown people in, like, another part of the world, but, like, I get paid for it, so whatever. And I think it's easy to condemn the students at UMass for that, but you have to keep in mind, Raytheon is paying for a lot of their degrees. Raytheon is paying for their research. So it's this culture that UMass has cultivated where people think that if you are a computer scientist, if you are an engineer, if you are a business major, your only option is to work for military, for war profiteers. That if you are at UMass, then that is what you are told and that is what the system tells you is true. But I want to read a little excerpt from a speech that one of our other organizers gave, Leo, at one of our marches. I want to read a little bit to sort of get into what we're doing to fight against this. So he said, he's mechanical engineering, he said, "We imagine a future for UMass engineers that is independent of war profiteers. UMass is responsible for providing students job opportunities that reflect their values rather than allowing one industry to monopolize our students and funnel them into destructive technologies. Instead, we imagine career fairs full of opportunities in renewable energy, waste reduction, equitable infrastructure development, and other sustainable technologies. Getting Raytheon out of UMass is the first step in divestment from war profiteers. We will set an example for a future of peace, justice, and equity. This is why we tell UMass to be fucking revolutionary," which is our motto. So that speaks to, I think, what we as students at UMass are trying to build towards, right? It's not just an anti-military campaign. It's forcing UMass to take responsibility and show their students that it doesn't have to be that way, just as it's our responsibility to make those choices and try to move away from careers in war profiteering.
Thank you, Noah. I think, what you spoke to sort of speaks to the way in which, like, the state weaponizes funding. And it's like, we'll give you money if you give us your lives and your people. And how that's sort of like a trade-off at a lot of universities. I know you're speaking specifically to UMass, but also like a lot of what I experienced from like talking to like architecture and engineering students of like this idea that your only jobs are these war profiteering companies. So thank you for that. I'm gonna kick it down to Alex. I really appreciate the ways in which you talked about, you know, the ways in which these corporations entrench themselves into our institutions. And Alan, specifically, I want you to tell us a little bit about another relationship
present between universities and militarism. And can you tell us a little bit more about like your fight for divestment that you've been working on?
Yeah, for sure. My campus, we built a Divest from Death coalition at the University of Houston with similar aims of getting the university to divest from the five largest weapons manufacturers. And just to take a step back on sort of like the dynamic and strategy behind that. So as we all know, universities are profit-making institutions, right? So private profit, or profit is their primary goal, and that informs their endowment strategy. So that informs the companies that they invest in and the organizations they invest in, which has the highest like return on investment, right? So because our universities follow where the money goes, and war is an incredibly profitable industry, our universities are deeply, deeply invested in companies which are responsible for arms manufacturing, and also for developing contracts with countries that are complicit in human rights violations across the globe. And just to give an example of that dynamic, the return on investment for Boeing was set at over 900% after the United States invasion of Afghanistan, right? So it's a very profitable industry. As students at the University of Houston, we have like a very similar dynamic. You know, we're a largely working class university, we're a commuter school. I think over 75% of the student body population is from the Houston community. So not only does that reflect like sort of the level of politicization that students come in with, it also reflects a deep investment in what the university is and is not doing in our name, right? And so we knew that, you know, the university profiting off of companies that were responsible for the colonization and occupations of our homeland was a red line for us. And we wanted to externalize that, and so we built our divestment campaign. And the strategy around our campaign specifically, but divestment more broadly, is to make contracts with states complicit in human rights violations not profitable for the company, right? So the idea is that by getting our university to divest from these companies, what they're essentially doing is selling their stocks in the company, right? They're saying, because you are engaged in XYZ activities, we will not put money into you, right? And the strategy around divestment is that if enough institutions, our universities, our faith institutions, etc., follow path, this puts enough pressure on the company for it not to be profitable to have, say, arms contracts with Israel or Saudi Arabia or etc., right? So that is the strategy around it. On one hand, you were trying to disincentivize companies from maintaining these contracts as a way to stop the literal arms of US imperialism, but the other strategy is to create a moral crisis around imperialism and endless war on campus. And while our campaign, spoiler alert, we had passed like the first stage of the campaign, which was through student government, and now we're working to actually get our Board of Regents to move money. While it did pass through student government, the real success of the campaign was the political consciousness and solidarity that it built on campus. I mean, I feel like I, especially after COVID, had not seen campus so agitated and politically invested in what our university was doing. So that is our campaign. That's sort of like the theory and strategy behind it. And where we're at now is we are, you know, strategizing how we can continue to apply pressure and mobilize different sectors like alumni and grad students to really put all eyes on the Board of Regents and specifically the trustee committee, the endowment committee to actually disinvest from these companies.
Thank you so much, Alex, for that succinct analysis. And yeah, just congratulations to you and your campaign and where you guys are going so far. To move down the line a bit, basically after hearing all these people talk, it's become quite apparent that profits are at the core of what these corporations want. And that's why their stake in militarism is so important, because of the profit. And Tommy, would you be able to speak to the ways in which
these corporations are able to amass such a large amount of funding and profit, and where a lot of that money comes from.
So the target for the campaign that I'm working on is the Boeing Company, the world's second largest war profiteer in the world after Lockheed Martin. And Boeing Arms Genocide targets Boeing because we demand an end to arms sales to governments that are committing mass genocide and across the world. But we're also demanding Chicago and the state of Illinois to divest from Boeing and the war industry and to stop taxing us to fund arms sales. So we also want Boeing to stop recruiting young people and building these bombs. And one of the things that Boeing does really well is that it has this intricate and complex PR campaign that puts youth at the forefront and also science and education at the forefront. And so they want us to kind of ignore the fact that they bomb other countries and other people's children and focus on the fact that our children could be the engineers for those bombs, right? And so we go to places like the Museum of Science and Industry, where there's a large exhibit of a Boeing like 727 plane, and it's just a one way of showing how Boeing will use education and science to kind of distract us from their work and how they profit off of making billions of dollars off of literal genocide. And so Boeing's philanthropic campaign and charade in Chicago actually only gave us $1.5 million for about 4,500 Chicago public school students and 100 educators. In return though, over the past 20 years, Chicago has given Boeing $60 million plus dollars through tax incentives and reimbursements. So back in 2001, when Boeing first came to Chicago, they came because Chicago officials lobbied so hard for Boeing to come because they promised Boeing tax reimbursements, and Boeing in return promised 500 corporate jobs, which weren't even required to be new hires, so those were jobs that were already filled. And also they promised these philanthropic projects throughout the city, things like the exhibit in Millennium Park, for example. And this is just one of the ways in which companies like Boeing that sit and make billions of dollars a year making attack helicopters and fighter jets and bombs, they also sit in cities like Chicago and make money off of us and our resources. And rather than giving citizens of Chicago resources like mental health or public schools for our kids, we're giving a big war profiteer $2 million a year. And one of the reasons that Boeing Arms Genocide came to be is because we realized that the war industry is deeper than just us looking at, you know, the damage that they do everywhere, but it's also about the culture and the mindset that we have. And so if Chicagoans are walking around not even knowing that their money, their taxpayer dollars are being sent to fund these bombings happening across the world, then why would we even say that Boeing is bad? Right? And why would we even know that? And because Boeing spends so much of its energy contributing to the culture of a city like that. And so Boeing is a war profiteering company at the end of the day, and it fills its pockets with money from death and destruction here and abroad. And their militarized portfolio is how they make most of their money. But also, Boeing being in cities like Chicago, they're taking away resources from the citizens and using literal tax dollars from us to fund and profit genocide abroad. So I just want to ground us in that and how they make money and also how we're contributing to that.
Thank you for that, Santi. I think, yeah, that just speaks to the ways in which, like, militarism is, yes, it's war, yes, it's, you know, the war profiteering companies, but it's also like a culture. And oftentimes we don't even know that we're contributing to it. And so that's why this movement of like young people is so powerful and so necessary and so urgent, because it's militarism is ingrained in like just the way that a lot of structures are set up. So thank y'all for that. Just to move the conversation forward a bit and open up more of a conversation, any of you guys can speak to these next few questions. So the first question, the U.S. empire is in a state of crisis. What nations and national liberation struggles challenging the hegemony of U.S. imperialism attacks on like working class folks. And so I just want to ask, through policy, might I add, so I just want to ask you guys, what does it mean to you politically, personally, to be struggling against militarism and endless wars? Why is this movement important to you? What is your personal connection to this work?
Yeah, I can start with that. So I'll start with a saying I'm sure many of us are familiar with, but imperialism is the highest stage of capitalism. It is the international dimension of monopoly capitalism and is therefore a facet of capitalism itself. So as a socialist, targeting militarism and US imperialism for me is not only a clear and critical strategy in weakening capitalism as an economic system, but is also a politically just position. So in the center and periphery dynamic, so in which the United States represents the imperialist center and the countries of the global south represent those in the periphery, a relationship exists in which the center, the United States, manufactures and facilitates a relationship of underdevelopment and dependency in the periphery. The US, through the threat of untenable debt, establishes hegemony over the periphery countries' economic spheres, and therefore fosters an apparatus over its political and cultural sectors as well. This dynamic allows for the United States to dominate critical industries, monopolize resources, and exploit their productive forces by paying workers pennies on the dollar, a relationship which only benefits the ruling class in the United States. It is this need for profit accumulation under capitalism that drives US industry east, or towards the global south, forcing thousands of US workers into a state of perpetual precarity and robbing us of our ability to provide for our families and establish power in our workplaces. Therefore, we must understand that monopoly capitalism is as influential and deterministic of domestic policy in the United States as it is foreign policy and of our imperialist strategy. So the United States achieves its imperialist objectives through its overreaching military force. So regardless of the narratives the United States creates to justify its invasions, its occupations, and its proxy wars across the globe, we know that reactionary wars function as a front to secure markets and the right to exploit labor and resources. In the Middle East, for example, the overwhelming military bases in Jordan and previously the United Arab Emirates exist to safeguard the US's apparatus over petroleum and combat against the threat of other forces in the region. The same motivation is true for the endless military funding to Saudi Arabia. And we see proof of this in Congress's outrage and threats of severing relationships with Saudi Arabia over their decision to sell oil to countries that we have negative relationships with. It is not the clear moral commitment to the lives of the Yemeni people which compelled the US to act. It's our financial and political interests which compel us not to sell to Saudi Arabia. This same dynamic explains the over $3.8 billion a year we give to Israel, the over 400 military bases we've established surrounding China, and the bolstering of separatist neoliberal political projects across the global south. So in conclusion, the US war machine, which has the blood of millions of people on its hands, is constructed and reified constantly in the name of protecting private profit, safeguarding our monopolies, and sustaining our ability to exploit the global south. If we understand imperialism to be the international arm of capitalism, hence Lenin's characterization, then we must also understand that the center of gravity in the capitalist mode of production has shifted to the global south. Indeed, the peripheries are rising. Across continents, responses to neoliberal reforms and subjugation to US imperialism are materializing through revolutionary movements for national liberation. This is only natural, as oppressed people must respond to their material conditions. While the class character of these revolutions often vary, their ability to weaken US capitalism, facilitating the rebirth of an international solidarity amongst workers, peasants, and farmers, and heightening the contradictions within the imperial center that we agitate against cannot be understated. As socialists struggling for the dismantlement of capitalism and the birth of the socialist future we deserve to live in, our analysis of what is to be done must center the centrality of revolutions of the global south. These struggles against capitalism and imperialism is a long one, and is built through the unequal advances at different times and in different conditions. Anti-imperialism soberly understands this dynamic and aids the peripheral revolutions. The struggle against the war machine, of which Dissenters has the honor of contributing to, is important to me and important to the struggle for socialism because it represents one of the most tangible ways that we can make a decisive blow to capitalism and build the future that we deserve to live in.
Thank you, Alex. Said it all. I think though what Alex spoke to just speaks to the ways in which, like, while we're talking about the fact that we're organizing in the belly of the beast, that the fight against foreign militarism is an international fight. And so with that, I want to move us into our next question about the ways in which international solidarity shows up in your work, and specifically y'all's chapters at y'all's campuses, and why is internationalism an important framework within your struggle? Anybody wants to speak to that?
I can speak to that. So Boeing has its claws in so many different places around the world, one of those being at the Mexico-US border, for example, where they launch different, where they have so many missile systems there, Apache attack helicopters there, and more or less the reason that Boeing even looked at Mexico-US border to begin with was for an ongoing stream of revenue, right? Just like Alex was saying, it's just so profitable to be at the nexus of a place where policing, surveillance, detention, and militarism collide. Where else would Boeing go? Places like Yemen, where they're suffering from one of the world's largest humanitarian crises, who else would be creating the weapons and bombs used to bomb the civilians there but Boeing? In Palestine, since 1948, since the inception of Israel, Boeing has been a crucial supporter to the apartheid state. Boeing profits off of the genocide of Palestinian people. And Boeing has always valued Israel and sees Israel as a strong customer. In Kashmir, for example, with India's ever-expanding occupation, it prioritizes building military bases around the world with what other arms than arms from Boeing? Places like Philippines and West Papua as well. And internationalism and international solidarity is so important to organizations like Dissenters and Boeing Arms Genocide because our comrades, for example, in West Papua are the ones that gave us strategies that we use in Chicago. So a lot of our victories, for example, the direct actions that we do, when we file for inspections in the Officer of Inspector General's office and we find out that Boeing isn't meeting their contract, suddenly we just blocked $2 million of our tax dollars going from Boeing for that year. And the only way that we come up with these ideas is when we talk to people around the world and we see how they're showing solidarity and how they're showing up for people, because as citizens inside of the empire, an empire like the US, it's our duty to fight for the people that the weapons we're making are being used against. And so the importance of internationalism always lands on how are we building solidarity and showing up with our comrades across the world and telling each other that, listen, we don't have to deal with this burden by ourselves. This is something that we can all struggle for and all fight for, and we can build off of one another to create these small victories. And those victories really do add up. So when you talk to somebody from a place like the Philippines or from Mexico or from West Papua, you can make those connections to how the US is impacting and harming the people on the ground over there. And so I think those are one of the main reasons that internationalism is so important to us at Boeing Arms Genocide.
I think at UMass, we are very fortunate to have a very diverse student population, and particularly we have a large international student population. I think in general we could do better in UMass Dissenters to do outreach within that population, but we do have a significant number of students who aren't from the United States who join us. And in particular, we try to center our campaign around the people who are really impacted by what Raytheon is doing, right? Talking about the people who are dying, you know, the fact that Raytheon's weapons miraculously show up in war zones across the world and, you know, wonder how they got there. But I think it also, it's sobering to see people from across the world, because it reminds us that imperialism and militarism is not exclusively a United States problem, right? We live in a world where, while the United States may be the largest sort of source of imperialism and militarism, you know, it doesn't matter if you are a worker in any country where your nation is being subjugated by another nation. It doesn't matter who's doing it, you're still getting subjugated. And I think seeing the sort of diverse population at UMass and understanding that everybody's coming from different places, and the main source of either what their country is doing or what is being done to their country goes beyond just the United States. It speaks to a universal solidarity of workers across the world to fight against militarism as they see it, regardless of, you know, how it relates to just the United States. And so I think that it's important within that framework to understand that the United States is not the only kid on the block, and to see imperialism and militarism in every form, everywhere.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.